Good afternoon and velkommen to the National Press Club. That's welcome in Norwegian. My name is Sonja Hillgren, and I am the Vice President of the National Press Club and Editor of Farm Journal. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our members of upcoming speakers. On Tuesday, November 7th, Ben Bradley of the Washington Post will reminisce about his life in journalism. On Wednesday, November 8th, Senator Chris Dodd, co-chair of the Democratic National Committee, and Haley Barbour, chairman of the Republican National Committee, will put their spin on the results of the November 7th elections and the upcoming 1996 campaign. And on Thursday, November 9th, Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbott will be on hand to discuss the Clinton administration's policy on Bosnia. Transcripts and audio and video tapes of press club luncheons are available by calling 1-800-NPC-2334. The National Press Club is also pleased to introduce the publication of a new book, The National Press Club's Best Contemporary Speakers, a book containing 13 of the best speeches made during 1994. To order a copy, call 1-800-NPC-2334. If you have any questions for our speaker, His Majesty, please write them on the card provided at your table and pass them up to me. I will ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. From your right, Nancy Kelly, American Metal Market; Harry Walker, Knight Ritter Photo Service; Jacob Mueller, Politiken Newspapers; Helga Ogrim, Norwegian News Agency; Gunnar Michael Bust, Norwegian Broadcasting; Bjørn Tore Gudal, Foreign Minister of Norway; and past the king for 1 second, Bill Hickman, Highway Users Federation and member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee who arranged today's luncheon; Fjeld Webe, Ambassador of Norway; Sharon Smichel, Acting Bureau Chief, Minneapolis Star Tribune; Michelle Marshall Cohen, Independent Photojournalist; and Jenny Topkins, Bloomberg Business News. I'd like to thank our staff members, Melissa Bender, Pat Nelson, Melanie Abdo-Dermont, and Howard Rothman, for organizing today's luncheon. Between 1820 and World War I, a third of Norway's population caught America fever. Translate that, America fever. They boarded ships for the United States. It was heart-wrenching for them to leave one of the most beautiful countries on Earth, with its majestic fjords, stately aspens, lush valleys, and snow-capped mountains that modern Americans grew to love via televised coverage of the 1994 Winter Olympics at Lillehammer. But there was little tillable land and limited opportunity in 19th century Norway. That was long before North Sea oil discoveries created blue-eyed oil sheiks. As hard as it is to believe, those 19th century Norwegian immigrants were not fleeing cold weather. Many settled in the upper Midwest, some of the coldest regions of the United States, and contributed to the progressive political tradition of that area. Then came World War II. Hitler's Nazi troops invaded Norway in 1940, when our guest today, King Harald V, was only 3 years old. His grandfather, then the king, and his father, the crown prince, held out against the Germans as long as possible, and then established an exile government in London. Meanwhile, young Prince Harald, his mother, and two older sisters crossed the border into Sweden in the dark of night and eventually made it to the United States. They found refuge with the Roosevelts, and they lived in Bethesda outside Washington, D.C. His Majesty remembers being a seven-year-old standing behind Franklin Roosevelt as he was inaugurated for his fourth term in 1945. So there are deep historic, cultural, and emotional reasons for this 24-day tour of the United States by King Harald and Queen Sonja to launch a Norwegian-American cultural partnership. With last night's overnight at the White House, this tour is coming to an end. His Majesty has been drumming up business for Norwegian companies, attending some NATO-related gatherings, and meeting with Norwegian-Americans. According to press accounts, the gatherings in Minneapolis and Chicago were love fests. Queen Sonia has focused on her interest in art, culture, and humanitarian efforts. Norwegians of all heritage can appreciate, I'm sorry, I misspoke, Americans of all heritage can appreciate the uniqueness of this Norwegian royal family. King Haakon VII, the grandfather of His Majesty, was a Danish prince who was actually elected King of Norway in 1905 after the dissolution of the Union with Sweden. Haakon's son, King Olaf V, that is Harald's father, was known for his common touch in mingling with the Norwegian people. Our guest today, King Harald V, is a general in the Army Force and an admiral in the Navy and has won national and international sailing competitions. And Queen Sonia was born on July 4th, our Independence Day. Both the United States and Norway, although vastly different in size, take their international obligations very seriously. King Harald is here today to speak to us about Norway's global outlook. As a Norwegian-American myself, I take great pleasure in presenting His Majesty, King Harald V of Norway.
Madam Vice President, ladies and gentlemen of the press, let me first express my sincere thanks to the National Press Club for providing me with this opportunity to address American media from this legendary rostrum at the end of a 3-week fascinating journey across the American continent. This is my first visit to the United States since I succeeded to the throne. I am not, however, a newcomer to Washington, D.C. As we heard, when war reached Norway with the Nazi invasion in 1940, my mother, the then Crown Princess Martha, my two sisters, and myself were invited by President Roosevelt to take refuge in Washington. The 16th of August, we sailed from Petsamo in Finland on board the United States American Legion through dangerous waters and arrived in New York some 2 weeks later. We remained in Washington for the whole 5-year occupation of Norway. First, we stayed partly at the White House and partly at the Roosevelt family mansion in the Hudson River Valley, as you know, Hyde Park. Later, we rented a house called Pukshill, and that is about a mile outside of the Naval Hospital outside Bethesda. I was 3 years old when we arrived in Washington and 8 years when we left. I can't say my recollection of that period is very detailed and precise. I do, however, remember well standing behind the President, then Roosevelt, when he was sworn in for his fourth term. So to sum up, I guess I have some claim to be called a Washingtonian. Last night, I had the opportunity to report to President Clinton and the First Lady the Queen's and my own strong impressions from our journey across the American continent. The vast dimensions, the magnificent landscape, the great economic and cultural creativity, and the dedication and optimism of the people we met. I am not suggesting that the United States has solved all its problems. Which country has? But we travel back to Norway today, very struck by what we have seen, and with a strong confidence in the future of this great nation. Americans and Norwegians have much in common, historically, culturally, economically, and above all, with the same strong belief in freedom, democracy, and human rights. As to our common history, I'm not going to dwell on the old Norseman's encounter with the American continent some 500 years before Columbus. A millennium we are celebrating during this last decade of the 20th century. I would, however, like to remind you that Norway's and the United States' common traditions and values are well illustrated by the strong historical and philosophical link between the Norwegian Constitution of 1814 and the American Declaration of Independence. The former draws heavily on the latter, for in 1814, when the Norwegian founding fathers were hammering out the constitutional platform for Norway's future as an independent state, it was only natural to look to the newly independent America and to the ideas and concepts which lay at the roots of the American Declaration of Independence and the American Constitution of 1787. It is also interesting to note that when Norway in 1905 regained her full independence, the United States was the first foreign country with which we established diplomatic relations on the day 90 years ago yesterday. Both the affinity between our two nations and their contact in human terms were very much strengthened during the 19th century and the beginning of this century, during which one-third of the Norwegian population emigrated to the United States. I have been told that only the Irish beat us as regards to this figure. Many of these Norwegians came from poor backgrounds, but they had the courage, stamina, and faith which was required to break up from their environment and seek, as your famous colleague and former member Erik Sævareid used to put it, a second chance across the ocean. Not all were lucky. The saga about the Norwegian immigrants contains many tragic chapters of misery and defeat, despite heroic efforts. Most of them did, however, manage to do fairly well, as borne out by their descendants. During my journey, I have visited several colleges founded by Norwegian immigrants in the 19th century. They stand there as living monuments of the immigrants' firm determination to help build this great nation and secure a decent future for their children. Some of the immigrants' descendants reached the highest echelon of American society. Suffice it to mention Chief Justice Earl Warren, Vice Presidents Humphrey and Mondale, and another prominent and more recent example, your present Secretary of State, Warren Christopher. Norway and the United States came even closer together as we became allies during the Second World War. This year, both Norway and the United States have been celebrating the end of that world disaster. Needless to say, in Norway, we shall never forget the decisive contribution the United States made to the liberation of Europe, and beyond that, to its reconstruction and rehabilitation through the Great Marshall Plan. For us Norwegians, the 5 years of war and German occupation will always stand out as a critical period when our readiness to fight for our freedom and democratic values was put to a crucial test. Together with our allies, we stood that test, and the Norwegian people are profoundly grateful to those who gave their lives, as well as to all our veterans, including the thousands of Norwegian seamen who helped to ensure that Allied military equipment and provisions arrived in time at the right destinations. In 1949, as new threats of the Cold War were building up, both the United States and Norway, with its strongly exposed strategic position in the north, became founding members of the North Atlantic Alliance. During the whole post-war period and right up to this day, Norway and the United States have been working together, both inside and outside the alliance, for our common defense and for peace and stability in the Euro-Atlantic region. The dramatic changes in the former Soviet Union and the fundamental improvement in East-West relations generally have, of course, had a very favorable impact also on Norway's security. Together with our allies, we are now discussing how NATO could best be adapted to the many new challenges in the post-Cold War era. International terrorism and crime, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, nuclear contamination, nationalistic and ethnic conflicts, and serious environmental problems. In all these fields, it is essential that Europe and North America work together. On the Kola Peninsula, Norway and the United States are today working closely with Russia with the aim of getting the grave nuclear waste problem there under control. In assuming new tasks for NATO, Norway will still consider it essential that the core function of the alliance be retained, among them, first and foremost, the safeguarding of the security of its members in a world which continues to be uncertain and unpredictable. In this process, the American security guarantee to the alliance member countries is of continued importance. In NATO, the allies are also discussing how NATO can best build new bridges to the new democracy in Central and Eastern Europe through the partnership of peace process and by incorporating some of the applicant countries in a gradual and transparent process, taking into account also their interest in becoming members of the European Union. Parallel to an extension of NATO, Russia must also, in one way or the other, be included in the dialogue on the future security architecture in Europe to make sure that an enlargement of the alliance does not create serious new divisions. In the endeavors the alliance is undertaking in these matters and for its future strength, the role of the U.S. will continue to be fundamental. In a related move, with the aim of stimulating cooperation between Russia and the West in the field of trade, economic development, and cultural and environmental cooperation, Norway has initiated a broad cooperative venture in the north, the so-called Barents Cooperation. This cooperation includes Russia and all the Nordic countries. The United States and the European Union are participating as observers. Turning now to our trade relations, let me remind you that extensive and close economic, cultural, and political ties with the nations bordering on the North Sea and the North Atlantic have always been part of Norway's life pattern. In our immediate vicinity, our relations have been particularly close with the other Nordic countries. Over the last few years, we have also strengthened our links to the Baltic states. Norway's economic activities have also, in many ways, been conditioned by the open sea around us. Navigation, harvesting of the resources of the sea, and international trade have played important roles in our economy. Norway's contribution to global merchandise trade is less than 1%. However, in certain areas, such as shipping, oil and natural gas, and certain metal industries, Norway ranks as one of the world's leading trading nations. Today, the merchant marine, under the Norwegian flag, ranks as the fourth largest in the world, carrying an important share of both European and American foreign trade. Since the 1970s, offshore petroleum production has become an increasingly vital factor affecting not only our domestic economy, but also our foreign relations. The petroleum sector accounts for some 15% of our GNP and one-third of our total exports. Through close cooperation with European and American oil companies, the Norwegian offshore oil and gas industry has become a very significant and reliable supplier of oil and natural gas to customers on both sides of the Atlantic. Western Europe absorbs more than 80% of our exports, and about 50% of our imports come from this region. Outside Europe, the U.S. remains our most important market and trading partner. As far as shipping and oil are concerned, the U.S. is our most important customer. Since World War II, Norway has also played an active part in the development of European regional cooperation. We participated from the outset in the successful offspring of the Great Marshall Plan, the OEEC, later OECD, and in the Council of Europe. Norway was also among the founding members of the European Free Trade Association, EFTA, which was the largest trading group in Europe up to the early 70s. Since then, an increasing number of EFTA members, including three of our Nordic neighbors, have, as you know, joined the European Union. A majority of the Norwegian people has, however, been reluctant to join the more far-reaching integration with the European Union. This has been reflected in two referenda, one in 1972 and one last year. In both cases, slight majorities gave negative votes, a democratic result which has, of course, been respected by all political parties. At the same time, Norwegian national interests are closely interwoven with those of the EU members, economically, politically, culturally, and in defense. Decisions taken with the EU organs will, in most cases, unavoidably also affect Norwegian interests. Although a non-member, Norway continues, therefore, to conduct a policy of close cooperation with the European Union. Norway's economic interests vis-à-vis the EU are primarily safeguarded through the EEA, the Agreement on a European Economic Area, which was concluded a couple of years ago between the EFTA and the EU members. 80% of Norway's trade is with the EU, and this agreement ensures that the Norwegian business sector, grosso modo, operates under the same general conditions as its European competitors. As to the increasingly important cooperation in the field of European foreign and security policy, Norway has for many years had a bilateral arrangement for political consultations with the European Union. This arrangement has enjoyed bipartisan support at home and has now been expanded. Furthermore, the agreement on the European Economic Area does also contain a provision for political consultations between the EU and the EFTA members, a provision which Norway is taking advantage of. Norway's interests and sense of international responsibility, however, reach beyond our immediate European and Atlantic environment. Broad and strong support for the United Nations remains a cornerstone in Norwegian foreign policy. We have been participating actively in the field of development and humanitarian aid, peacekeeping, environmental protection, and human rights. Although Norwegians only make up 1/1000th of the world population, Norway has provided about 7% of the total number of persons who have served in U.S. peacekeeping operations. The preservation of peace is not, however, a goal which can be achieved solely through mediation and peacekeeping. As we are reminded every day, peace and stability in the world are threatened by ethnic strife and religious intolerance, major inequalities, poverty and social degradation, and lack of democratic reform. Against this background, the UN's efforts to promote social and economic development, protect human rights, and support democratic values become extremely important. It is true that the UN has its shortcomings, and as the organization celebrates its 50th anniversary this fall, Norway takes an active part in the efforts to strengthen and reform the organization and prepare it for the many new challenges ahead. In this context, Norway is concerned about the financial strains which have, for some time, weakened the UN's ability to solve the many essential tasks assigned to it. We regret that so many countries are behind in their payments, and we are concerned about proposals that could further erode the financial viability of the World Organization. Our strong commitment to the promotion of international peace has strengthened Norway's credentials as an international mediator and go-between. Our late Foreign Minister, Johan Jørgen Holst, and his collaborators contributed substantially to the breakthrough in the secret negotiations which led to the Oslo Agreement between Israel and the Palestinians. Today, Norwegian diplomacy continues to take an active part in the efforts aimed at providing a realistic economic basis for the implementation of the agreement concluded in 1993. A sound and stable economy has not only given Norway the opportunity to provide its own people with a high living standard and a broad social safety net, it has also allowed us to play an active part in international efforts for the development of the less favored parts of the world. In fact, since the beginning of the 50s, thriving economy, together with broad popular support for development assistance, have made Norway a major donor of foreign aid. Since 1983, our development assistance has constituted more than 1% of our gross domestic product. Our aid is primarily directed towards improvements and sustainable development for the poorest developing countries, with Africa as the major recipient. Norwegian aid has also been focused on alleviating the plight of women and children and protecting their human rights. The concept of sustainable development implies, of course, that we, the industrialized countries, must face up to our responsibility and be prepared to change our patterns of consumption and implement effective national environmental policies. In Norway, we feel that the values of international cooperation, human development, self-realization, and a sound environment came extremely well together when we had the privilege of arranging the 1994 Winter Olympics. I'm sure the American people will have the same experience in Atlanta. The Olympics bring nations and people closer together within a framework of peaceful and friendly competition. At Lillehammer, we took special pride in seeing to it that the games could be green games with a profile of environmental awareness and with the least possible detrimental impact on the local environment. Before concluding, let me add that our visit to the United States coincided with the greatest effort ever in the presentation of Norwegian culture in this country. The programs called Norwegian Visions encompass visual and performing arts, ranging from 19th and 20th century painting, ancient and contemporary folk art, to music, dance, theater, literature, and film. Here in Washington, a few weeks ago, the Queen had the privilege of opening a very representative exhibition of the National Museum of Women and the Arts, called At Century's End. Norwegian Artists and the Figurative Tradition, 1880 to 1990. This exhibition documents important contributions to figurative art made by Norwegian women artists through some 100 years. The museum is also hosting a series of surrounding cultural activities. In the context of my remarks about Norwegian immigration, let me also mention the exhibition Norwegian Folk Art, The Migration of a Tradition, at the Museum of American Folk Art in New York. This exhibition highlights the artistic legacy and the richness of the cultural heritage which Norwegian immigrants brought with them to the United States, where the tradition was pursued and acquired new meaning as it expressed ethnic pride and identity. I thank you again for giving me the opportunity to speak to the American press and the American people about my own country and its close, friendly, and time-honored relationships to the United States. Thank you very much for your attention.
Your Majesty, for Americans who haven't had the privilege of touring the most beautiful country on earth or one of the top couple, could you give them a travelogue of where they ought to travel when they visit Norway?
Depends what you want to see, doesn't it? I would suggest the West Coast in May, June, probably.
Is that all?
That's all. That's enough. I tell you, if you see it, that's enough.
How about a boat trip up the fjords?
Well, that's where they are.
Right. These people, a lot of these people just don't know. They don't know how beautiful it is. They haven't been to Bergen. They, you know, you have to kind of lead them along. It's a big world out there. You got to sell your country.
Well, our country isn't very big, but it's long. And it has a very long coastline. And we think ourselves, anyway, that we have a very beautiful coastline. That's what I would suggest for somebody visiting Norway for the first time. Probably the part of Norway that most foreigners know most about and heard most about, seen pictures from.
There are, I understand, 5 prototypes of electric cars that have been sent from Norway to California. Does the U.S. auto industry face competition from Norway sometime down the road? And please tell us about those cars and how they are used in Norway.
They are, in fact, very new. I think they're prototypes also in Norway. I don't think there are any more than a couple in use there either. But the idea in the California ones was that they would be commuter cars, and people could come and collect them when they go off a bus or a train and go to their place where they work. And somebody else, while they were there, could take them and use them while they were there. So this is a sort of, they expected about 500 of these, I think, to be in California by the end of about 5 years. And they're, of course, being electric, they are clean and they are good for the environment. And I think that's why they wanted to try and see how it worked.
Your Majesty, when you toured Minnesota recently, did you try to persuade American Norwegians to return home? If not, why not? Then this questioner says, whatever, we don't want to lose them.
Well, no, that was not the object of the exercise. The object of the exercise was to keep our close relations with them. I didn't say that in my speech, but you might know that we have more Norwegian Americans in America than we have Norwegians at home. So the answer to the question is, well, we don't have room.
That's why they left in the first place. Norway seems to have a tradition of strong women, a female prime minister, cabinet members, etc. Why, and to what do you attribute this?
I think we've had a long tradition of women's emancipation, and I think that's one of the reasons for it. And I think we have quite far equal of the sexes in our country, and have had for quite a while. And I think this is one of the reasons why.
The Oslo waterfront has been developed into one of the world's most beautiful urban areas, but is there any truth to reports that this impressive architectural achievement may be threatened by building of a large container and shipping industry?
Ah, somebody has been somewhere very shortly. That's quite true. There is a big discussion going on where the container harbor should be, and Oslo Harbor is one of the alternatives, yes. If it will destroy Oslo's harbor area, I doubt, but there are people in Norway who are very much object to the idea because of that.
Do you predict that Norway will continue its harvest of medals in the 1998 Winter Olympics? This questioner has read that Norwegians have de-emphasized Olympic winter sports. Is there any truth to that?
I don't think they de-emphasized it. They ran out of money, to put it quite frank. But you be careful. I think they'll be back in 98.
Well, I didn't know whether I should ask this next question, but it's quite appropriate in view of your answer. The only club member, this is the National Press Club, to win the National Press Club's annual chess tournament 4 times was the Norwegian correspondent from Oslo, Per Egil Heggie. The Norwegians, do you play a lot of chess? That's cheaper than winter sports. It's
no,
warmer, too.
No, I don't play chess, unfortunately. I know how to move the bits and pieces, but that's about it.
It wouldn't be very nice to be moving the king and queen around, would it?
She goes faster than I do, doesn't she? So.
Now we're going to get to the serious question. It's interesting that the Europeans voted not to join the European Union. Besides the economic reasons, and you touched on that in your talks, what is it about Norwegians that would make them not want to join the European Union? Is there something besides the economic benefits?
Many also Norwegians, I think, have asked themselves this question. And I think I'll tell you a little story that I experienced in 1972, just after the first referendum. Well, I went up north, and I asked just that question, why? Why did you vote no? Because up there it's about 80-90% no. And they said, you know, Oslo is a very long way away from here, and Brussels is twice as far. And I think that's the core of the whole situation.
Americans have turned inward and are reducing foreign aid, while Norway has maintained its foreign aid at the highest levels in the world. Is there any danger of isolationist sentiment growing in Norway? And what would you say to Americans who want to reduce their foreign commitments?
Well, I don't think that there's any real danger in Norway of reducing our foreign aid substantially. That has been a tradition in our country for, as I said, for many, many years, and I think it's going to continue. Now, as for the Americans, I think they have to take care of themselves.
Indeed, they do. But are you going to let that opportunity pass about telling the American people about obligations to help in the world?
Well, I think I touched it a little bit. I think that's enough.
What is Norway going to do when its oil supplies run out? Do you have a conservation plan in place?
Well, maybe the foreign minister would be closer to me to answer that question, but we are trying now to make a fund, what we call an oil fund, for the future generations, so that we don't use up all our oil money today, but to save some of it for the future generation exactly when the oil runs out. But you must remember that we have oil for the next 20, 25 years, but we have gas for the next 100 and 150 years. So it's a bit in the future yet.
This is an interesting question. I don't know if there's anything to it, but it's kind of fun to ask. Is there any likelihood of a North Sea oil cartel similar to what was shaped in the Mideast, and why not?
Why not? I don't know. But I doubt that there's any prospect of a North Sea oil cartel, quite frankly.
Something to do with the psyche. I mean, the Norwegians wouldn't do it, would they?
I don't think so.
You mentioned the Partnership for Peace. Do you favor NATO membership for the Eastern European countries? And what about the Russians and the other countries, former Soviet Union?
Are you asking me personally, or are you asking Norway?
Either one.
Well, let me try and give you a part of the Norwegian standpoint here, and then I'll leave it to my foreign minister to elaborate. I think we are in favor of Partnership for Peace. We are in favor of maybe in time widening the NATO alliance, but I think we have to be very careful to have the Russians in on it, so, and the Russians agreeing on every step we take. Otherwise, we are making the world a less safe place than we already have. I don't know if the foreign minister will want to elaborate on what our Norwegian official stand is.
Your permission, Your Majesty, only a few additional words. There is general support for enlargement of the NATO and the PFP, of course, but we need to be certain that enlargement doesn't create new tension. After all, we see a more safe Europe now than we did some years ago, with the exception of events in Bosnia. And we have to handle the relationship to Russia with the same vigor as we handle NATO enlargement. The applicant countries have a legitimate need to be met, whether the Czech Republic, Poland, or the others. But we also have, of course, to build down what is still left of mistrust. We should be inclusive with the Russians, which means that we take an active role in developing Russia socially, politically, the market economy, and all the rest, because the potential of the extreme Russian nationalism will be enhanced if there is no just social and economic development in Russia. Consequently, we should try to be inclusive and to collaborate with those forces which are eager to cooperate with the West, and they are there in present-day Russia. So this is really a two-track road. Enlargement in principle, yes, but also broad efforts to include Russia in a more civilized world based on political democracy and market economy.
You're lucky you have such a good representative. Your Majesty, he brought up Russia. Why is Norway helping Russia expand its brass aluminum smelter when Russian overproduction is hurting the world market? Will Norway follow suit of other European countries and privatize its Norsk Hydro aluminum company?
Well, now you're in on a sector that I know very little about, I must admit. But I think I've read in the papers that we're doing this to better the environment in Russia. Because they are pretty dirty, those factories over there. And I think that is one of the reasons why we're doing it. Maybe you have a better answer than I have. But
Your Majesty, not really, but the Pechenga nickel is really the major source of pollution in northwest Russia and in northern Norway. And it goes without saying that we are choked by it, and so are the Russians. But this is in an area with huge unemployment. And what have you got to offer them, apart from the northern fleet? which we want to build on, which is a huge military capacity from the old times. So for years we have tried to collaborate with them on how to modernize that factory. Of course, there are some market effects on that, but they are producing anyway and at a cost which cannot be defended.
Norway has contributed to the peacekeeping troops in Bosnia. Do you see Norway continuing to support that?
If the UN wants us to stay there, I'm sure that with a lasting peace agreement, we would stay there too.
75 years ago, Woodrow Wilson received the Nobel Peace Prize from the Norwegians. Today, how is Wilson's vision for Europe viewed in Europe, 75?
Well, I think Europe has changed a bit since then, hasn't it? It's gone through a couple of nasty periods, and now I think that we are looking towards, hopefully, a better, more peaceful period in Europe. So far, all the large wars in the world have started in Europe, and I hope that that era is over.
Do you think the World Trade Organization will work? Do you see someday a trade barrier world?
Well, it's difficult to see that at the moment, but what's the alternative? So I certainly hope that the World Trade Organization works.
How closely involved were you in the recent Mideast peace negotiations?
I wasn't involved at all. I knew it was going on, but that was all.
Your Majesty, what are Norway's policies or plans to help restore the depleted North Atlantic cod fishery?
Could you say that again, please?
Yes. Your Majesty, what are Norway's policies or plans to help restore the depleted North Atlantic cod fishery?
That's not carry on delivery, is it? It's the fish we're talking about. We are doing what we can. We have, for many years, been fishing with very small quantities to try and reestablish the cod family, which is swimming around in our region. It is now growing quite nicely, so nicely that, from our point of view, other nations now are starting to fish, and which, of course, our fishermen are not very pleased about, as they have voluntarily not fished as much to try and build up this cod population. And now that the population is growing, and until the population is strong enough to really have all these fishermen fish on it, it's already started to being fished upon by non-Norwegian and non-Russian, because they've been in on it too. The quotas are being overfished, and our fishermen are worried.
As you've indicated, Norwegians pride themselves on being good world citizens, especially when it comes to the environment. Yet there's controversy regarding the resumption of commercial whaling by Norway. Could you explain the reasons for this?
I'm surprised it took so long. We have this expression of sustainable development, and we traditionally have looked upon the whale as a national resource. And we think, and that is also our official policy, that if the whaling population, as well as the cod population or shrimp or whatever, natural resource can be fished upon. We think that we have an obligation and a right to do so, as long as we only reap the part and make the development sustainable. We see it as a right and an obligation to do so.
You think the American trade policy toward Norway is fair, for example, in the area of salmon?
We have one of our few problems with the United States is actually on that issue. And we have a tax in this country on fresh salmon that more or less excludes Norwegian fresh salmon from the market. And of course, we would like to see that abolished. But I think it's a problem to another fora and not this one.
You have earned many accolades in your own sailing. Has Norway ever considered a mounting in America's Cup challenge?
Well, I've had this question many times, and I more or less given the same answer every time. If we want to make fools of ourselves, we can do it much cheaper than that.
Now, this is sort of a fun request that came up from the audience. Someone here wants to have a show of hands to know how many people at the luncheon are of Norwegian descent. So put your hands up. That's pretty good. Probably not as high a percentage as you had.
No,
but not bad for Washington. Now, we have to get to this other matter, Your Majesty. Next time when you go to the White House, are you going to be late for dinner?
No, I'm not.
I would like to present to you a certificate of appreciation for coming to speak to the National Press Club. And also, I would like to present to you a book, Eye on Washington, The Presidents Who've Known Me, by George Temes. He was a New York Times reporter who took photographs of every president from Roosevelt to Bush. And want to thank you very much, Lange Tak.
Thank you.
For coming to speak to us today. And then, just sort of continuing on and the last question, I want to explain that we know in this country that our president often is late things, and it's called Clinton Standard Time. And we'd like to know, have you adjusted your watches to Clinton Standard Time?
Well, we prefer our own standard time, actually.
Lange Tak.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.